Greetings, urban farmers, gardeners, and healthy food visionaries. Farmer Greg here, and welcome to the 811th episode of the Urban Farm Podcast, where every day we work together to educate and inspire you to become part of your food revolution. Today's episode is a replay of our monthly Rosie on the House radio show that we do live in Phoenix on urban farming. Today is all about bees. Enjoy.
Rosie on the House, every Arizona homeowner's best friend.
Come on around back, Arizona, Saturday morning, 8 o'clock, the outdoor living hour of Rosie on the House. If you're following along in your homeowner handbook, we've got Farmer Greg in the Urban Farming Hour, and we're talking keeping honeybees. And Farmer Greg, you've got a special guest joining us. He's got quite an impressive bio.
Oh my gosh, absolutely. I've known Cricket for maybe two decades, and she's always been amazing with what she does around homesteading. So today we have Cricket Aldridge to talk about her experience with suburban homesteading in the desert. Cricket is a natural homesteader growing up in rural Idaho with a garden, a horse, and lots of home canned food. She brings those sensibilities to her farm in North Phoenix. Add a little dose of cottage garden flavor and permaculture tendencies, and you'll see why her blog, bloomingaz.com, is a reflection of everything she does. Cricket is a longtime beekeeper brought in by Mead. I'm curious about what that is. Now she runs a farm called Blooming Ranch and teaches people every day about bees, chickens, and more. Thank you for being here, Cricket.
Thank you.
All right, let's just start where the obvious. What is mead?
Oh my gosh, mead is deliciousness. So it's actually a fermented honey wine. So the Vikings used to make it. It's essentially honey with water and yeast, and it ferments to an amazing, delicious drink that's a little bit high in alcohol content, but that just adds to its yumminess.
So if we ended up at a party, you'd feed me some and I'd get a little bit loopy.
Probably.
Nice. So today we're talking about keeping honeybees. And I guess where we want to start is honeybees are one class of bees, but there are literally thousands of other kinds of bees. Can you make that distinction for us?
Oh, yes. So there's about 20,000 species of bees in the world and about 9 species of honeybees. And
wow.
And then of those 9 species of honeybees, only one lives in the whole Western Hemisphere, and that's Apis mellifera. We call it Western honeybee or the European honeybee, and it's not even native to the United States. The Pilgrims brought that over.
So were there bees in the Americas before that, or just not the honeybee variety?
Yeah, there were bees. So, you know, I did say there's 20,000 species, so a lot of them are here. And what's really cool, so the United States has about 4,000 species of native bees. And just the Sonoran Desert has about 1,200 species, which is the largest number of multiple species of honeybees in anywhere in the world. Not honeybees, of bees in the world. So we call those native bees as opposed to honeybees.
And break down a colony for me. What are all the different roles of the bees? You've got your queens, your drones. What are all the different functions of a hive?
Oh my gosh, it's a beautiful story. It's called a hive is called a superorganism for a reason. So it consists of one queen, tens of thousands of female worker bees, and a smaller percentage of drones, which are the male bees. So the queen is the only one that lays eggs. She's the only one that can produce more worker bees or more queens. And that's her only job. And then there's the worker bees, which can be in a full-size hive, 50,000 worker bees, all doing jobs to make it work. So that as soon as a worker bee hatches, it goes through a series of jobs until it dies 6 weeks later. So it hatches, spends 3 weeks inside the hive doing housekeeping. It feeds baby bees, which are larvae, dehydrates nectar to make honey. They make wax. They build comb. They take out dead bees. We call them undertaker bees. So all of those bees go through all of those jobs until finally they're ready to start foraging. And then they'll spend the rest of their life going back and forth, getting water, pollen, and nectar for the hive. And then drones are the males, and drones' only purpose is to mate with queens from other hives, and then they die. So in the winter, when there's no food, they get kicked out. You'll see bees, the workers actually drag them out by their feet and drop them in front of the hive, and they try to get back in, and they won't let them get back in because all they do is eat the resources, and there's no need for them because they don't mate with their own queen. And one interesting fact about drones is they have no father, but they have a grandfather.
Oh, whoa, hold on. What? How is that possible?
I was trying to decide if we should spend any time figuring that out on air.
Let me just explain it really quickly because it's one of the most fascinating things. The worker bees tell the queen whether to lay drone eggs or worker eggs by the size of the comb. She measures it with her legs. If it's a drone-sized comb, she'll lay an unfertilized egg. So that unfertilized egg will become a drone. So it's 100% her genetics. So I don't know how it happens. But that's how it happens. That's why they have a grandfather but no father.
Fascinating. I have never heard that before.
Neither have I. So what do we get out of a beehive?
Oh, my gosh. Right? I had been talking earlier to Greg about how important bees were and why pilgrims even brought them over to the New World with them, because bees provide honey for medicine and for sweetening their food. They weren't making sugar back then. And they didn't have electricity back then, so where were they getting their light? They needed beeswax to make candles, and they used propolis from the resin that the bees collect to make medicine, and of course, pollination for their crops.
And they do a whole lot of pollinating, don't they?
Absolutely. That's why I think sometimes honeybees get pushed aside because they want to emphasize native pollinators. But if you think about native pollinators are solitary bees. They don't live in colonies. They have a tiny nest with just a few brood, whereas a honeybee colony in one hive, that's those one of those white boxes, can have 60,000 bees in it, which is a huge workforce if you want pollination for your crops, which is why you'll see fields, alfalfa fields, melon fields with multiple hives at the ends of them, because that workforce is all going out at once to pollinate those crops. Whereas if you didn't have them at all and rely on solitary bees, I don't think you'd get the job done.
Wow. So you started keeping bees a few years back to make mead, but you found so much more that they do. Why would somebody want to keep bees?
Making mead, the number one reason you would want to keep bees. All right, there are some other reasons. People I've come in contact with who want to be beekeepers, it's for a few reasons. One, people just think it'd be a fun hobby to have, and they're right. Two, some people want the honey, which is also a really great reason because you can use it for so many things. It helps with allergies, for one thing. They also want to have bees in their garden to pollinate their crops, to pollinate their vegetable garden. I hear from people all the time saying, would you please put a hive in my garden? I'm not seeing any bees. And what was the other reason? Oh, yeah, mead.
We got that one down. Okay. Now, if somebody was going to have bees in their yard, you were talking about native bees being a little solitary and just a few of them. Are those hives available to go get and place in yard for a small garden?
Like a honeybee hive?
No, just a smaller native one. Or do they just show up naturally?
They just show up. They're just part of our ecosystem here. You can get little bee houses or make little areas that they prefer to make their homes in. People make little houses with bamboo because they like to make leaf cutter bees, cut the leaves and roll them up and put them in a tube like a straw. And that's where they lay their eggs. So there's those kinds of things for mason bees and other leafcutter bees like that.
If you will build it, they will come.
Yes.
Where the honeybees, yes. There's the market and
yep.
A chain of resources that you can purchase those.
Yeah, you really do need to purchase your bees if you're going to get honeybees.
And we'll talk more about that here in a little while. But there's two kinds of people that you mentioned to me the other day when we were talking that jump in and keep bees. Who keeps bees and how do they do it?
this is my observation. So there's the person that gets interested in beekeeping. And so they buy all the books and they watch all the YouTube videos and they spend a year or 2 years just trying to feel prepared to finally get bees. In fact, they probably have a hive in their garage that's been sitting there forever. And then there's the
with no bees in it.
Yeah, empty. Thank you. And then there's the other person that just decides, I'm going to get bees. They call up, order bees, order a hive, and start from scratch. That's me.
Figure it out as I go.
Yeah. Yeah. That's how I learn.
Well, there's a lot to figure out. Where do we start?
The best place to start is to meet some other beekeepers. Join a beekeeping group. Go to the Arizona Backyard Beekeepers Facebook group. I highly recommend that. You'll learn a lot just from other beekeeping.
There's over 5,000 members, I noticed. Is that primarily Arizona?
It is.
So a lot of great community there to get started with. You can find that link at the archive page of today's podcast at rosieonthehouse.com. We'll be back with Farmer Greg and Cricket talking keeping honeybees. Keeping honeybees and the Urban Farm Hour with Farmer Greg and Cricket Unvary have a new name. Congratulations.
Thank
on your
you.
Marriage. We were just getting started. You were talking there's two types of people. They do a lot of research or they jump in. Let's just say I'm somebody that wants to jump in. Where do you go buy a beehive?
There's a few different ways you can buy bees. You can buy a package of bees, which means you're going to order a package which consists of 3 pounds of European bees and a queen that's not their queen. It's after the commercial beekeepers come back from pollination. They split all their hives. They dump all the bees together and scoop them out and give them a queen. So you can get a box like that. Comes in the mail, about $200. Or you can get a nuke from a local beekeeper who basically is a beekeeper whose hive got big and they split it. And so that's going to be 5 frames of bees. And interestingly, that's about $200 right now. But it's bees with a queen that's already laying eggs. It's got brood. It's got honey frames already. It's like a mini hive ready to go. Or you can buy a full-size hive that's all ready to make honey. And that's going to be about $400. So those are the ways you can get bees. Or you can collect a swarm because it's swarm season right now. I don't recommend that for new beekeepers because we do have Africanized bees here. And they're going to have to deal with that and requeen it, which means to buy a new queen that is already mated from Hawaii, Northern California, and replace the old queen. It's a big job for a new beekeeper, but you can do it, and it's cheaper that way.
What kind of space do you need, and can you just plop one down in the backyard in the city?
Yeah, actually, all the cities around Phoenix have different laws. Some are very easy, some are very hard, meaning you have to be zoned rural. You have to have a certain distance from your neighbor's property line or a building. Phoenix actually has the easiest, and Scottsdale, easiest rules to follow. You need 1,700 square foot per hive. I think you can have 4. I'm not sure all of those. You can look it up in your zoning online.
Yeah, check with neighborhood services in your city. They'll know.
Perfect. And it's a good idea to ask your neighbors if any of them are allergic. However, most people think they're allergic and they're not. So maybe don't ask. Forget that. but you don't need a lot of space. And if you think about it, it's not like chickens. They're not finding their food in your yard, right? The bees can go 3 to 5 miles to look for food. So you're just really needing space to put the hive, to give them some water, and for you to actually move around your hive and be able to open it, stack boxes. So it's really not that much space that you need.
Now, you'd mentioned chickens. When we have smaller animals like that, we've always got to have pens for them or protective areas. Is there anything you have to do to the box? I don't know of any natural predators that just go knocking over beehives.
No, especially in central Phoenix, you're not going to find too many. No, you don't really have any protection. I have bees out on BLM land, and there's cattle all around it, and I don't have to do anything specific, but you do need just be aware of the elements. Like, shade is super, super important for bees because their houses are made out of wax, and wax melts in our summer heat. So shade is super important, access to water, and wind. You don't want the hive wind coming and blowing the lids off. So sometimes we put rocks on it. But really, there's not a lot of predators here.
I've got this old visual in my mind of Winnie the Pooh stuck in the tree eating honey. If somebody's on the eastern side above the superstitions globe, there are some bears that come down from the rim on that area. Do bears just go straight into the hive and they're not affected by the stings?
Oh, they're affected, but they don't care. So, yeah, a lot, like skunks actually do to eat the brood and the honey. Brood means the eggs and larvae, pupa, and bears do too. So they like the honey, but they also like that protein. Yeah, you really definitely, if you're living in northern areas or wilder areas, protect it from
bears and skunks. Okay.
Bears and skunks.
Now, you had mentioned water. How much water do
honey
does a honeybee hive need?
In the summertime is when they really need it, because what they're actually doing with that water, they're not using it to drink. They get their water from the nectar that they take. But they have to use that water to cool their hive. So bees have to keep their hive at about 95 to 98 degrees no matter what time of year it is. So if it's 120 out, they are spending almost all their time collecting water to spread it on the comb. And then they have other bees that stand at the entrance and fan with their wings to create an evaporative cooler. So they will go through gallons of water in a day in the summer.
Fascinating. During the winter, they don't
need it? Not so much. They still need it, but I don't see them too often in the waters because the nectar's, 98% water.
Keeping honey bees with Farmer Greg and the Urban Farm Hour, along with Cricket Ungberry of Blooming Ranch. You can find their website, bloomingaz.com. If you're just joining us, it's the fourth Saturday of the month, which means we're in the Urban Farming Hour with Farmer Greg, and we're talking keeping honeybees, and he's got special guest Cricket Ungberry of Blooming Ranch. Where do you want to take it from here?
Let's talk about what bees need. So, it's like, I got a hive. What do I need to do for them?
That's awesome, because that's the job of a beekeeper, right? Where it's like a farmer or rancher takes care of cows. We take care of our bees. And so bees need certain things. They need a home, right? We call that a beehive. So they need a home that's protected from the elements, especially the sun here in Arizona. They need it to be protected from animals that might harm them, should be protected from African bees that might want to attack it, and also the pests and diseases, which are numerous. You don't know those things until you're a beekeeper. And so a beekeeper's job really is to make sure that the bee's home environment is healthy and safe, and that they have enough food, and that they have enough water, and basically that's it.
And like you had said, unlike chickens, where they're only going to be foraging in your backyard, bees can go 3 to 5 miles. What? How do I know if they're getting enough food? Or is there supplemental food I can get? You got those hard bird blocks you can throw out in your backyard that birds come pick at. Is there a pollen bee block on the market?
Actually, that's a really good question, because right now we're seeing flowers everywhere. There's the mesquite blooming, Palo Verde's blooming. We call that a nectar flow. Every state has its own nectar flow season, and that what kind of plants that are blooming, and that designates what kind of honey you're getting. Right now, it seems so abundant, but come June, it's not going to be so abundant. So you might see flowers blooming. You might see oleanders, lantana, bougainvillea. But guess what? The honeybees don't get anything from those flowers. So as a beekeeper, your job is to look inside the hive. So every other week, we open up our hive and we look at every single frame, and we determine what, if they have food in there. Do they have enough honey stored? Because that's what the bees are going to eat when they don't have flowers to go to. And do they have enough pollen stored? Because pollen is what the nurse bees eat to make royal jelly that they feed to the larva. You need to make sure there's enough of all of that inside your hive, and that there's no diseases that are evident or pests, and then you do some research to figure out how to help that. If they don't have enough food, if there's not enough honey stores, you're going to have to feed them sugar syrup, which is basically a one-to-one ratio of sugar to water. And you have to use white sugar. You cannot use brown sugar or natural sugar because those have things in them that can cause distress to the honeybee's digestive system. White sugar is actually the most similar to pure nectar. I know it sounds bad that, oh, I'm feeding my bees candy, but that's what they eat. We don't eat candy, but they do, or sugar. And then if they don't have enough pollen stores, then we feed them powdered pollen. It's not real pollen. It's a pollen substitute, which is, pollen is protein. Honey is their carbohydrate. They have to have both. You'll know. That's why you look in your hive. If they don't have enough of any of it and it's not available out in nature, then you feed it to them.
And you were talking about looking for diseases. What are your signs that your hive might be sick or that something's attacking it?
Thankfully, in Arizona, we don't have as many diseases because of our dry, hot climate. There's some really bad ones that affect moist environments, but here we have something called varroa mites. Actually, the whole world has varroa mites, and it is the worst problem for honeybees. It's a little tiny mite that looks like a tick that jumps on a honeybee, goes back to the hive, and reproduces in the hive and carries diseases. There's a particular disease called deformed wing virus. So when that varroa mite goes into a pupating cell, it will reproduce and spread this disease that causes the bees to hatch with their wings all shriveled up, which means they're pretty much ineffective as a bee. They can't really help the hive. And if you see something like that in your hive, you need to, there's some treatments you can do to help. It tells you that you have varroa mites, but you also have to do tests regularly to see how many mites are in your hive. And then you can treat it with different acids, formic acid, oxalic acid, various treatments you can look at. But most beekeepers around here have to treat their hives about 3 to 4 times a year for varroa mites. Yeah, it's a big problem. And if you look nationally, we lose about 45% of all our bee colonies every year. And varroa mites, the most significant reason for that.
The other reason might be Africanized bees, yes?
Well, yeah, they're not causing our colony loss, but they are causing a lot of distress for beekeepers.
Well, let's go through that, because 20 years ago, I remember it was big sensation. Uh-oh, we've got Africanized bees now in Arizona. And then about 10 years ago, we had talked to another beekeeper. Now they're all Africanized. It's not a big deal. You just got to know how to work with them. And then 10 years later, where are we at?
Okay, but Africanized bees came here in the early 90s. They originated from some beekeepers bringing them to Brazil to increase their honey production. And they didn't understand that African bees have certain behaviors different than European bees. And they thought they could control that, and they couldn't. So they basically started swarming, because African bees do multiple swarms, which means they are reproducing their colonies many more times than European bees do. So they're spreading and mating with the other bees, and they're a dominant species. The drones are faster. They mate for longer periods. And then they also take over hives very often. The reason we don't like to have African bees is because they're very defensive. So if they're out on flowers, you wouldn't know that it's not a European honeybee. But when you start messing with their home, they get really defensive. So instead of a European bee sending out a couple bees to warn you, tap you, be like, hey, stay away, they'll send out half the colony and chase you down the road. And it's pretty scary. And so if you've got that kind of a colony in your backyard, they've been known to attack entire flocks of chickens and kill them. I hate to think of a child being outside, or dogs, horses. So you really have to be careful. And that's why we don't like keeping them in a neighborhood setting. About 98% of the bees' wild colonies in Arizona are Africanized at this point.
And if I'm keeping honeybees, how do I know that I've been Africanized? Like you said, the half the swarm will just come out. And is there anything I can do at that point? Or do you have to just start over, get rid of that hive, and Bring in a new one.
So, like I said, you're going to be inspecting your colony every other week. And part of that is to make sure that bee that you have in there is the queen bee that you put in there, which we make sure to mark our queens. We put a paint dot on her thorax so that we can see her easily and then also know that's our queen. So if you go in your hive after a week, you're not going to really see the behavior change. But if you find out that the queen is not the one you put in, it doesn't have a mark, that tells you your hive is going to become Africanized because she'll start laying eggs and replacing that colony's genetics. If you wait to inspect your hive after a month, then you'll notice when you walk up to it.
And when you say you're marking the queen with a, what? How are you doing that?
I use a special little, a little cage. It's called a one-handed queen catcher, but it looks like a push pop. And you put the queen in there, and you press her up against a little grill so that her thorax is exposed. And then you just use a paint marker, and you just rub her. There's five colors that are internationally used for each year. So that we know how old our queens are. This year it's green, so all the new queens will be colored green.
That is so fascinating. Who gets that right job? You said you get to do it. That sounds like a very labor-intensive job. And isn't the queen like all the way in the middle of the hive?
Yeah,
where
I mean,
you get to her?
Like I said, you're inspecting, so you're looking for her. And as you get used to inspecting your hive, you get an idea of where she's going to be. So you look more closely in the center where the brood is because that's where she's laying her eggs. But sometimes it's really hard and you have to go through your hive multiple times to find her and catch her.
The world of beekeeping, as told by Cricket Ungvary of Blooming Ranch and Farmer Greg with the Urban Farm. You've hit mead a few times, and that's on our talking points here for this segment. So dive into that byproduct of honey.
Okay, so...
Or maybe not honey, but of bees.
Yeah, it is made from honey. Honey mead is just... It's so simple, but then you... It's something that you build on and can have some amazing flavors. So it's basically honey. Usually the proportion is about 3 pounds of honey, 1 gallon of water, and some yeast. And then, of course, a brewmaster's or a mead master's going to add some other things to it. You can, there's some brew stores here in Phoenix that you can get like a kit for making mead. And then you just let it ferment and rack it, ferment, keep fermenting. And you can add fruit or some other things. And oh my gosh, so good.
Cricket's beverage of choice, I take it.
It is. And it's sweet, but you can get some dry mead too, actually. It just depends on how they brew it and how they ferment it. But I so recommend trying it. It's delicious. The Vikings made it.
You had mentioned that earlier, and I always picture Vikings in cold climate. Were they?
Yeah.
So they're pulling these bees out of these.
The Vikings pretty much populated Ireland, right? And lots of the lower regions. But yeah, honeybees can live in all kinds of areas. So, yeah, the Vikings had it. The Egyptians had it.
How did the bees keep their hive at 90 degrees in Ireland in the wintertime?
That's really
impressive.
That's a good question. Basically, what they're doing is consuming all that honey they stored during the nectar flow. They're eating it to create, so they can basically vibrate their wings and their bodies to create heat. And they cluster together. So the hive really reduces in size, and the queen's not laying very many eggs, and they actually produce winter bees that can live for months instead of weeks. And they cluster together in a smaller group and vibrate and consume all that honey.
And there's a couple other things you've brought in that you make out of your honey. We'll get to that in the final segment here at Rosie on the House right after this. All right, down to our final segment here, talking keeping honeybees. Cricket, you've brought in a couple other products. This isn't mead, right?
No, it's not.
You said it might be a little melty because it's been in the hot car, but
yes.
This one says bug bite balm.
Yeah. Yes.
A bug bite balm from bees.
Yeah. So nice. Bug bite balm is.
Does it work on bee stings?
Yes, it does.
Awesome.
Yes, it does.
And it's made from, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Oh, it's okay. So it's made, I make these products from the beeswax that I get usually from my bee removals, which the beeswax itself is super medicinal because it's made from all the plants the bees are visiting. And then I add jojoba oil from the jojoba that I harvest, and then creosote, which is already super medicinal, propolis, and some honey, and then just put it on your skin and you'll be instantly healed. Just kidding, you won't be instantly healed, but it'll feel good.
Nice. And another a thing that happens this time of year, and I've seen it in my yard, is that a ball of bees will show up hanging in a tree, and I've always told people, oh, just let them be. They'll move on, but maybe that's not the case.
Yes, I'm glad you said that, because that is the typical response for people, and it's actually true. They do move on because all they're doing is resting. It's a colony that has reproduced itself, and so they're resting while scout bees are going out looking for a new home, and this is where the problem lies. That new home is possibly going to be in your valve box or your attic or your shed floor or your speaker or your couch. I've found them everywhere. But it's way cheaper and easier to call a beekeeper to come get it while it's hanging in that tree than when we have to cut open your ceiling months later when you realize they're there.
And how, I'm sure it's different every time, because we had that happen in our pomegranate tree one time. By the time a bee relocator that was in the area got out, it could have been 3 hours and they're already gone.
Yeah, it just really depends. It could be a few hours, it could be 3 days, but I think it's safer to call somebody.
And you guys do that bee relocation?
Yep, that's what we do every day right now. People call us and we come out and remove the colony and take it to our apiary and place it in a hive, and that colony continues to live and make honey for us.
Oh, how cool is that?
Yeah.
And when you say make honey for us, and you mention these products you make out of honey, where's the farm stand?
So the farm stand is at our house on Happy Valley and Fifth Avenue up in North Phoenix, and we have chickens, we have eggs. The chickens make the eggs. We have peacocks and a garden that we sell produce from, and beehives where we actually do beekeeping classes.
And if somebody's not in that area, you've created a local Facebook group for beekeepers in Arizona.
Yeah, we started the Arizona Backyard Beekeepers Facebook group. It's super supportive. It is where I would recommend anybody go to start learning about keeping bees here. We have monthly meetings with the Arizona Backyard Beekeepers Association the first Tuesday of the month. And then there's also another group called the Beekeepers Association of Central Arizona, BACA. I know. Yeah.
And we have all these links already on the archive page for today at rosieonthehouse.com. Homeowner Resources, the podcast, Keeping Honeybees. This is segment four. All the links are right there to make it easy. But tell me about I've never heard of this, the Arizona Honeybee Festival. Did I read it right? This is like the eighth?
It is the eighth year.
Wow.
I know. It's crazy.
Awesome cricket.
Yeah. I'm super proud of it. The whole point of having this festival is to promote beekeeping in Arizona and to invite the community in to learn about bees. It's a free festival at Paradise Valley Community College this year on November 9th. We have live bands. We have speakers. So we have beekeeping classes all day long that are free. We have demonstrations. We have vendors. We have honey tasting. Lots of kids' crafts, all bee-related. It's really a fun event, and we also have a bit of a fundraiser trying to get some money for a license plate that we would like to have that would help us help bees and beekeepers as well.
Well, you are a busy bee, Cricket.
Yes, I am.
Nice. And I've been to the festival before, and it's amazing.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks for cutting time out for us today. You said this is your busy season, and you already got 6 calls for relocation today. I hate to cut into your productivity, but we really appreciate it. It was really a very fun hour. A lot of great information. Is there any Anything left that starting beekeepers should know? Obviously, we got all these resources to get started.
If someone's interested in keeping bees, just go on our Facebook page and start asking questions. I think that's the best way to go about it. And you can always message me, call me. Beekeepers love being resources for other beekeepers. So please feel free to talk to anyone on our group about doing that.
Very good. Farmer Greg, thanks for lining this all up. And we'll talk to you in May. Yes. We're going to be talking desert soil building. That's very timely for coming into the heat season.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And just real quick, it's bloomingaz.com, right, Cricket?
That's right.
All right, awesome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode of the Urban Farm Podcast. Remember to listen for tips, advice, and resources to help you on your journey with urban farming. You can find us on the web at urbanfarm.org or send us an email to podcast@urbanfarm.org. In the words of Vincent Van Gogh, great things are done by a series of small things brought together. Be encouraged that with each lesson learned and skill developed, you are one step closer in the direction of your dreams.